Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Construction began about May 10th, and just days later, an incident occurred that might have caused the fort builders to accelerate their pace. An attack by Black Hawk to the south on members of the Illinois militia near the Rock River. The settlers at Blue Mounds had no idea that the attack was Black Hawk's attempt to broker peace with the militia members, whose panic at being confronted led to several deaths, both white and Indian.
Fort Blue Mounds was a stopgap defense measure for settlers in what is now southwestern Wisconsin in 1832. Its military value was short-lived, but what does it tell us about the lives of the men and women who inhabited it? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What events led to the hasty construction of the fort? Did it serve its purpose? And what do archaeologists find there today? Our guest is Robert Birmingham, former state archaeologist in the Division of Historic Preservation, professor of anthropology at the UW-Waukesha, and the author of various books dealing with Wisconsin history, including Life, Death, and Archaeology at Fort Blue Mounds, to be published this year by the Wisconsin State Historical Society Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Well, thank you very much.
Before we get to Fort Blue Mounds, can we take a little bit of time and talk about Blue Mounds? Who was there and what is significant about this geographical region?
Well, Blue Mounds is located about half an hour, 30 miles west of Madison, Wisconsin. And in 1832, it was literally the first settlement of non-Indian people in what is now Dane County. The people were drawn there largely because of lead mining. This is on the eastern edge of Wisconsin's lead mining region. And those familiar with Wisconsin history know that a large non-native population had been drawn to Wisconsin originally because of lead mining in the southwestern part of the state. So around 1828 or so, several people, including a gentleman named Ebenezer Brigham, established essentially what is now the village of Blue Mounds as a lead mining community. The community was very small, largely consisted of lead miners, but there were a few farmers in the area that grew crops to support the lead mining industry.
And what else was going on in Wisconsin in this kind of pivotal decade of the late 20s and the early 30s? We have long established white settlements in Green Bay and over at Prairie du Chien. And
right.
Where else?
Well, about that time, there was a village called Milwaukee that had been established also, and also largely based or coming from trade with Native Americans. And in 1832, also, southern Wisconsin had a very large Native population. To the east were the Potawatomi, and to the west were the Ho-Chunk, including the area around Blue Mounds. Just over the hill from where Ebenezer made his settlement, there was a major camp of Ho-Chunk people, with which Brigham carried on a minor fur trade. But we have a lot of Easterners coming in and other immigrants from the Old World. But we can't forget that actually the place was already occupied by many Native people.
And the movement has already been underway in Congress and in the Jackson administration to relocate Indians to the West.
Yes. In fact, 1830 was the year in which the United States government changed its policy towards Native people. Previously, treaties were made, which greatly reduced property, of course, of Native people. But there was some accommodation. But in 1830, some public officials, Andrew Jackson especially, saw that it was not possible for Native people and and Americans to live in the same areas, and devised a rather draconian policy of removing all of Indian people by force, if necessary, from the eastern part of the United States, that is, east of the Mississippi River to west. So the Black Hawk War, which occurred in 1832, came at a time when already there was efforts underway to deal with, quote, the Indian problem, and that is that settlement was taking place on areas that were already occupied by natives, and that the American government had decided to solve that issue by removing native peoples. In Wisconsin, trouble had already started. Already as late 1820s, friction between the lead miners and the Ho-Chunk occurred many times, leading to deaths on both sides, a lot of tension. The Ho-Chunk were particularly angry that the lead miners were mining lead on property that the Ho-Chunk said had been guaranteed to them by treaties. So already some violations of treaties was taking place. And so just prior to the Black Hawk War, we have a series of incidents that have been called the Winnebago Uprising, where there had been attacks on settlers, but again, stimulated by the anger of the Ho-Chunks that there had been some trespassing and the general sense that white settlers are flooding in and this was interfering with the Ho-Chunk life.
And how significant is the figure of Black Hawk to this story?
Black Hawk is, I think, one of the great figures in both American history and certainly in Wisconsin history. Black Hawk was a warrior chief. I mean, he was the head. He was relied on for decisions with regard to warfare and in related matters. Because of his great experience, he had already distinguished himself as a great warrior leader and a great warrior and so on. Black Hawk, at the time of 1832, had been displaced to Iowa as a part of this general process of relocating Indians.
Displaced from where?
Displaced from Illinois, just across the river. But the displacement had already taken place in that area already in 1804. A treaty was basically coerced on the Sauk and Fox people that would give up lands in Illinois in what is now the Quad Cities area, but a large part of Illinois. And some Sauk had agreed to move across the river to Iowa to make way for settlement in that area. Black Hawk and others were quite upset with that treaty, did not agree with that treaty, and thought that the people who had signed the treaty on their behalf, in fact, were traitors to the Sauk and Fox Nation. So he was had through his life been angry at this situation. And for a time, he and a number of others just simply refused to move to Iowa. Finally did under some coercion. But as the problems increased, he sort of changed his mind and decided that, no, this is our land. This is our homeland. It had been taken from us. And so he vowed to reclaim it. Simply move back to that land. And so that stimulated the so-called Black Hawk War. And the Black Hawk War is important because it was one of the last great conflicts east of the Mississippi River. And it showed that Indian people were resisting white settlement to a great extent. But also, it plays a big role in Wisconsin history because after the conclusion of the Black Hawk War, this conflict had given the federal government the excuse they had been looking for, and that is to remove the rest of the native people from Wisconsin. And right literally months after the conclusion of the Black Hawk War, the federal government was already meeting with the Ho-Chunk and Potawatomi, making deals for the land, and made it very clear that they had to give way and to move. by the end of the 1830s, most of southern Wisconsin had been cleared of Native population. Some people refused to go.
How many people are we talking about? If you
several thousand. Mm-hmm. Several thousand Potawatomi and Ho-Chunk. And, you know, the rest is Wisconsin history. With all of that land freed up now, the land was subdivided, and we see 1836, Wisconsin becomes a territorial capital. 1848, there's enough of a population to make a state. So without that conflict, that would not have proceeded in that manner. So I always like to point out that Black Hawk War is the most important event in Wisconsin history because literally made possible for the state of Wisconsin.
What are people using for roads at this
Indian
point?
Trails. Mm-hmm. Indian trails. In 1832, the major trail in the southwestern part of the state was in fact a trail that went from Prairie du Chien through Blue Mounds into the Madison area and then headed out west. And it was quickly adopted as a military road that connected the forts of at Prairie du Chien and Green Bay for movement of troops and so on, so that the Indian Trail used previously became known as the military road. And then as settlement increased, then other roads were made. But it was largely the trails that the Indians had used. The miners used the same trails to move their goods and so on.
Any sensitivity on the part of the settlers to burial grounds, Indian mounds and so on, or just complete
No. I mean, they were moving into very much an alien country. Those kind of sensitivities were not a part of anybody's consciousness at the time. But I have to point out, not even the settlers, when they came in, they didn't have much of a sensitivity to even previous settlers' burials sites. And they would often simply take tombstones out and plow the ground because the priority was survival. You know, it wasn't I think the 20th century and the 21st century has given us sort of a sense, a wherewithal of taking into account a lot of values that were not there among the early settlements because they couldn't be there. It was just a matter of survival. So you did everything you could to survive and didn't think too much beyond, you know, that sort of thing. So, and of course, attending the early settlers was an attitude, a very negative attitude towards Native Americans. They saw the Native Americans as standing in their way. They certainly believed the accounts before they came that the Indians were savages and murderous savages and very much threatening the life of people. The Black Hawk War fed into that when the settlers around Blue Mounds heard that Black Hawk had moved into Illinois and was moving north. They could only conclude that they were going to be murdered very shortly.
And we tend to, I guess, forget how quickly a fort can be put up, although I gather even back in Roman days it was not unusual to erect a castra at the end of each night's march.
Yeah. The settlers, were people who were very used to constructing things, just using the materials around. But several of the people in Blue Mound, several of the lead miners, actually had experience in this in that they had been around for several years during this, quote, Winnebago uprising when, especially in Illinois, the lead miners and other settlers built forts to protect themselves from this uprising that really never happened. So there was even some experience in taking wood and in making the fortifications that they thought were necessary.
So for the decision to start erecting a fort at Blue Mounds, the main impetus would be then fear of Black Hawk?
Yes. The scare began in April of 1832. And that is when Black Hawk and about 1,000 people somewhere in that neighborhood, men, women, and children, but also many warriors, but men, women, and children crossed the Mississippi River and headed in the direction of Saukinuck, which was Black Hawk's beloved home village, and where he often said that is where his ancestors are buried.
And where would that be?
And that is in Rock Island, Illinois today. And the settlers there were literally building houses on burial grounds of Saukinuck in other areas, much to, you know, to add sort of insult to the injury. And so they started moving up in that direction. And the governor of Illinois was a state at that time. The governor of Illinois made the sort of ironic declaration that Native Americans, the Sauk and Fox, were invading Illinois, and sort of outsiders invading Illinois, and that, and therefore calling for the defense of Illinois. At Rock Island, there was a fort and a military, U.S. regulars, but Illinois, and as well as Michigan Territory. Wisconsin was Michigan Territory at the time. And both Michigan Territory and the state of Illinois raised militia. Many, many thousands of men then volunteered to deal with this. So the actually communication at the time was fairly good. There were no telegraphs, you know, obviously, and so on. But as you read, a word spread like wildfire that Black Hawk had invaded Illinois and was moving northward. And this spread community to community, and also the military sent out word. For example, the United States military authorities alerted a person here in the southwestern part of the state named Henry Dodge.
Yes, famous mover and shaker.
Absolutely. He was sort of the boss hog of the lead mining district, but also was the it was the head of the Michigan Territory Militia, which had been formed previously during this Winnebago scare. So he had an operation. So basically the military – well, not basically. They told Dodge to get the people to fort themselves, that is, to build fortifications and move in. So all this, you know, was percolating up. And even by the time of Dodge's message, and he sent out couriers to all the communities, including Blue Mounds, to say that danger was imminent. But already the Blue Mounds people, the miners there, had heard that Black Hawk was coming up. And they were getting, of course, many reports of encounters and attacks and so on. So they had already begun building a fort, even as the official word was given them. And the construction began in May. And at that point, that's all they knew. A large group of Native Americans were heading their way with the intent of killing them. And so under those circumstances, they very quickly built a fort. But as you mentioned, Norman, they knew what they were doing.
And where do you choose to build a fort? I mean, if you're expecting to be – well, Indians weren't really big on siege warfare anyway.
No.
But if you were expected to be holed up for a while, let's say, you had to pick a place that was defensible, but didn't you also need water?
Yep. The community of Blue Mounds is at a geographical location of two large, very large hills or small mountains called the Blue Mounds, two very large hills.
So you build toward the top of that?
Well, you would think so. But if you ever been to Blue Mound State Park and you're at the top, you would see immediately this is a very lousy place to build a fort, because it is so big that you can't really see the sides, you know, of it. You know, you couldn't see anybody creeping up at
right.
all until they're on top of you. And further, it was wooded at the time. So you have a wooded – you have a high location, but it's wooded. You can't really see. So they didn't decide to build on the Blue Mounds. Rather, they picked a hill in the prairie to the south of the Blue Mounds. And this hill was small enough so that you could see all sides. It's a rise in the prairie. But also being in the prairie allowed you to see in all directions. And this was also the place where Ebenezer Brigham had his lead mining diggings. So he picked the lead mining diggings because the people had already been working there. And you had this strategic location because you could see Well, in fact, you could see when we were working out there, we could see on some days the water tower, you know, in Dodgeville, which is quite some distance away. And the lead mines, of course, were producing lead. And
handy for those bullets.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you had a seemingly inexhaustible source of ammunition. If you needed it. The water thing was interesting in that that was the one thing that seems to be missing from that. So they moved up there without any obvious water source on that property. Now, either they thought that they weren't going to be there very long, or they may have had a water source that we don't know of. And I keep thinking, well, the lead mines were right there.
Right. Just dig down instead of sideways, maybe, to get water instead of lead?
The mines were already in existence, and no doubt had been water-filled, you know. Uh-huh. They were down deep enough so you'd get some seeping water. And sort of the effects of lead poisoning were not only known, but that was the least of their problems. You know?
Just staying alive.
Yeah, right. If they lived old enough to be, you know.
Driven crazy by lead, that was a good thing.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the building of the fort and the fate of the people in it when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Robert Birmingham, who has worked on the archaeology of Fort Blue Mounds, a phenomenon of the Black Hawk War in Wisconsin. We've determined that they have, these settlers, these lead miners mostly, have built this fort out on the rise on the prairie, so they have line of sight if anybody's going to come after them. But we're not quite sure about how they're getting their water.
Yeah, and the first death at Fort Blue Mounds occurs, in fact, getting water. Ebenezer's establishment, he ran a wayside, he ran a small mercantile business, a tavern. Travelers coming through the area would stop at Brigham's place before they got to Madison, for example. And Brigham's establishment, which is right across the street, actually, from Cave of the Mounds today, was placed where it is on the slope of one of the Blue Mounds because there was a large spring there. Now, there are no creeks or major rivers in that area. Sugar River is further away. But so you have some small drainages, but a couple of springs. And so he established his place at the spring. So just after they had built the fort and had occupied it, drew in other residents living in the area. There weren't many, but he drew in some other people. Several fellows went up to the spring to get water. And that this is written in historical accounts. So we know that at least for a time, that's where they were getting their water. They were getting it from Ebenezer's spring. They were probably getting the water and then storing it in barrels at the fort. So that is the way they apparently solved the water issue, at least for a time. So in early June, two fellows went up. One was named James Aubrey, and he becomes the first casualty of the Black Hawk War in this part of the state. In fact, of the Black Hawk War period. He and James Smith go up to the spring and then are immediately attacked by some native warriors.
Would these be warriors on horseback?
It's unclear from the historic record, but they did steal the horses of the two men. And there was only several of these men, but they jumped the two guys. They killed James Aubrey immediately. And the other guy, again, his name was James Smith, he left his horse and his gun and went running back to the fort. And we have one account left by a very unusual character named Esau Johnson, who says that he was out on his buckboard with his wife going to plant some vegetables in their garden for food, and saw Smith running, screaming with blood coming out of his nose from exertion, you know. And then they went into the fort because apparently they were being attacked now by Native Americans. Now, one would think, well, their nightmare had come true and that they were being attacked by Black Hawk. But this is June 6th, and Black Hawk was nowhere near the area. It wasn't even close to Wisconsin at the time. And it turns out it was local Ho-Chunk, two local Ho-Chunk warriors who had done this. And we know that because after the war was over, one of the Ho-Chunk chiefs from southwestern Wisconsin admitted that some of his men, in their excitement, had jumped these guys. And that can be explained two ways. First of all, again, the Ho-Chunk had very good relations with the people of Blue Mounds in general. But there was still this simmering anger about settlement in general. And so that sort of tension. But also we have some historical accounts, fascinating historical accounts, indicating that one of the individuals apparently involved, Ho-Chunk individuals, had already had words with one of the settlers, specifically a wife of one of the settlers, in which insults were exchanged, you know. And so there apparently was a grievance there that needed, in the mind of one of the warriors, had to be settled.
So it's interesting. I mean, that when we think of the Black Hawk War, we think of a lot of mostly nameless, faceless people just kind of blasting away or,
right,
you know, shooting away at each other without thinking that it could also involve some personal conflicts.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, the value of looking at history like I have been, is looking at the war through the personal histories of the individuals involved. What were their motive? What were they thinking? What were their motivations? And we find with a lot of the Native people, there was just a lot of personal injuries that had to be addressed, where a large group of Potawatomi, one of the great massacres that has been talked about a great deal, occurred in Illinois. Warriors attacked settlers and killed an entire family except for two girls, Rachel and Sylvia Hall, who they had taken captive. And, of course, this played in national press like you wouldn't believe, teenage girl captives of the savage Indians. But the Potawatomi were not a part of Black Hawk's army, you know, or his band. But when Black Hawk stimulated a idea of resistance and acrimony towards the settlers, these men had seized a chance to, again, settle some personal grievances they had against this specific family. So,
now, you have in the booklet that you've put together about discovering the story of Fort Blue Mounds, it's a picture of the abduction of Rachel and Sylvia Hall, but it shows them being brought to the safety of Fort Blue Mounds.
Yep.
Tell me about that.
All right. May 29th, and this is fairly early, and this was even before the Aubrey's death at Blue Mounds, but there occurred this massacre in eastern Illinois of this family by Potawatomi, and the Potawatomi are said to have been accompanied by some Sauk and Fox warriors. So there was some sort of collaboration going on there between Black Hawk and the Potawatomi, but obviously this was a Potawatomi revenge raid, basically. But the girls were taken captive, these teenage girls, at the time, and then apparently turned over to the Sauk and Fox warriors. For what reason, we don't really know, but maybe as leverage, you know.
Bargaining chips, right, or possibly even, ransom was redeemed.
Probably not so much ransom, but yeah, bargaining. Mm-hmm. And also a demonstration of power, you know, obviously. But anyway, so this caused, a great anguish that these girls had been taken. And again, it played in national press that these teenage girls had been abducted by the Indians. And the military authorities got right into it and asked the people at Fort Blue Mounds, in fact, to inquire among the chiefs of the Four Lakes area, that is the Madison area, where Ho-Chunk people had been living. And the chiefs and the people in the Madison area, Indian people, had pretty much told the federal authorities that they were neutral in this whole thing and that they were not going to raise their weapons against the Americans. So inquiries are made among the Ho-Chunk of the area, and very quickly, within a few days, the Ho-Chunk reported that they could deliver the girls to the authorities for a payment, you know. And in fact, the federal authorities already told Ho-Chunk that they would give them a lot of horses and other rewards for this. But it took place in a few days. And then shortly after, about June 11th, they showed up near Fort Blue Mounds with the girls. The chiefs of the Four Lakes and other surrounding areas brought the girls, and they were met in an area near what is now Mount Horeb. And they were released, and they all went at that point back to Fort Blue Mounds and had a welcoming for the girls. The women in the fort took care of the girls, and they were ultimately repatriated with family members in St. Louis. So the exchange involved Fort Blue Mounds. It's a very famous hostage release story. Unfortunately, the people surrounding Henry Dodge came out, of course, to supervise the release. And he brought with him his militia members. And some of his militia members reported to him that the Ho-Chunk who had accompanied the girls were still making some ominous comments about what the white people were going to get from Black Hawk when they showed up. And this and the fact that the Ho-Chunk had delivered the girls in surprising speed led Dodge to conclude that the Ho-Chunk knew where Black Hawk was, and Black Hawk was missing at the time. The federal authorities couldn't find this whole huge band. So in sort of an extremely misguided strategy, Dodge took hostage the hostage release party and kept these chiefs hostage until they would agree that indeed they would not further collaborate, or if they were collaborating, or have anything to do with Black Hawk. So this was obviously a great insult to the chiefs, which led to a further acrimony between the two peoples.
I would think so. Can you describe the fort, you know, what it was built out of and how high up the walls would have been? Were there lookout towers, you know, just on a sort of physical level?
How much ground did it cover?
What was this?
That is very interesting because we had historic records about the fort, and the historic records said it was 150 foot on a side, which is pretty good, pretty big, and had walls about, I think, something like 16 feet high, two corner blockhouses, log blockhouses, and then a central building where people lived and stayed. And that was what we were looking for when we began excavations at Fort Blue Mounds to locate the fort so that it could be preserved. And what we ultimately found out was it was not nearly as big. It was, in fact, about one-third that size. And the people who were at the fort, actually, and who later described the fort later in their lives when they were recounting their glorious deeds, had greatly exaggerated the fort and misled us in our archaeological excavations. We kept looking for a big fort and ultimately came up with it, which was a much smaller one. It was adequate, of course.
How many people would it have held?
The fort itself was occupied at times with up to 40 to 50 people, which would have been really cramped.
And was this like a temporary place they went to when they were feeling threatened, or did they just sort of move in there?
Well, when they constructed it, I'm sure the idea was this was going to be as needed. But the killing of Aubrey in early June indicated.
They needed it now.
They needed it now. So right after the killing of Aubrey, everybody pretty much moved in and didn't venture out too much after that, unless Dodge and his militia were somehow in the vicinity. Dodge ran a group of militiamen that were called Rangers, and their job was simply to ride all the trails between these communities and look for any enemies or any threats. So he frequently came out to Fort Blue Mounds to, you know, check on things. So, but the miners themselves, maybe one or two had some prior military experience, but they were virtually unarmed. I mean, there was only a few rifles among them, a couple pistols, and those mostly belonged to Ebenezer Brigham. And they were stolen by the Indians when during the attack on Aubrey. So after that death, they pretty much were locked into the fort and practically unarmed and had very little food. And they kept sending messages to Dodge saying, we need guns, we need help. And Ebenezer Brigham kept a little journal, very, very brief journal among his account books. He took his account books, precious account books, with him to the fort. And he kept a little journal there, and he complains that Dodge won't help him, won't give him any help, and seems to have some malice, you know, because he won't provide them with arms. But to be fair, Dodge was essentially in charge of about 13 forts that had been constructed in southwestern Wisconsin. Yes, there were that number just in Michigan Territory. In Illinois, there were a lot more forts. In fact, we have a count of over 80 forts, temporary fortifications that were constructed in mostly in Illinois, along the Illinois River, and in the southwestern part of the state. And it would appear that just about all settlers had taken refuge during the Black Hawk War. Essentially, the Black Hawk War stopped life as usual on the frontier.
How many of
everybody these, going to these forts, or many of them went to the federal forts. But in essence, the entire frontier had been cleared out of settlers during the Black Hawk War. So panicked was the population.
How many of these forts do we know the whereabouts, or how many of them have been excavated?
Only three forts have been excavated. One is the Apple River Fort in Elizabeth, Illinois, and the state of Illinois and some private concerns reconstructed the fort based on the archaeological excavation, and it's now operated as an Illinois state historic site, so you can visit there. And we visited that place a lot in order to get more information about Fort Blue Mounds, because it was exactly the same time. Another fort was occupied in eastern Illinois, and it was basically just a big fence put up around a farm. The fortifications by settlers varied. Some of them were proper military establishments like Fort Blue Mounds and Apple River Fort, so on. Others were just fortifications thrown up around houses. You know, they fortified a house and threw up a fence. Sometimes they just made an enclosure and people moved in and lived in tents for a time. So there's great variety depending. Some forts were made especially for the militia. That was they would make a fort. That was their headquarters. At Mineral Point area had a number of fortifications because of a larger population there. But several of the fortifications, the settlers moved in with the families, but they also were the bases of operation for Dodge's militia. Dodge's own house, he fortified, put a fence around, and that was the headquarters of the Michigan Territory Militia at a place we now call Dodgeville.
We'll find out what archaeologists find at Fort Blue Mounds when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Robert Birmingham, whose new book coming out later this year is called Life, Death, and Archaeology at Fort Blue Mounds. Take us with you as you go on this excavation. What did you find, and how did it match what you thought you'd find?
Well, it all started in about 1989. I was state archaeologist at the time, and as part of my responsibility, I had that of helping to protect, locate and protect notable archaeological sites in the state. And so wide-ranging sites, very ancient rock art sites where Indians put art on cave walls, to many of our famous Indian mounds, village sites, 12 to 13,000-year-old sites that were inhabited where the glaciers were still in the area. But case of the Black Hawk War sites came up as a part of several issues, and one was a piece of land along the Wisconsin River where the Battle of Wisconsin Heights took place. Now, the Battle of Wisconsin Heights occurred when Black Hawk actually and his band moved through the Madison area, escaping and for the most part staying away from the military and the militia who were chasing them. And so at what is now the area of Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, the militia, Dodge's militia, finally picked up the trail of Black Hawk, who had been eluding several thousand U.S. soldiers and militia. They couldn't find him, leading the President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, to become furious at the military that 1,000 people on foot could not be found by the United States military. But anyway, they picked up his trail in Fort Atkinson area, the militia did, and moving ahead of the United States Army, moved through Madison area and with the militia hot in his trail. And the militia caught up with Black Hawk's band near the Wisconsin River, near present-day Sauk Prairie community. And there, the militia engaged Black Hawk in a rather short but sustained battle called Wisconsin Heights. Black Hawk was able to fend off the military, and again, his band escaped. But there were some deaths, and it's a famous battle. Again, Battle of Wisconsin Heights, July 21st, 1832. The property where the battle took place came up for sale, and there had been some talk about it being developed. And so as Wisconsin state archaeologist at the time, this concerned me and made some inquiries with the Department of Natural Resources, which coincidentally at that time was in fact purchasing property along the Wisconsin River as a conservation area, and working with one individual, especially named Dave Jensen, who was the head of the program at the time, we were successfully able to have that property purchased, and so the battlefield was protected. So at the time, I thought, well, this Black Hawk War was very important, and there are a lot of sites involved in that in Wisconsin. And so I started to investigate what other sites need protection, and that brought me to Fort Blue Mounds. One of my colleagues said, oh, by the way, did you know that the State Historical Society owns Fort Blue Mounds? And at that point, I didn't.
That's convenient.
The trouble was, we didn't know exactly where it was because the deed for the property only referenced the remains of the fort. So you had to know where the fort
really
was
there anymore.
In order to know where our property was. We knew the general location. But we're on this hill that I talked about, you know, it was somewhere up there, but it had apparently been marked with cement markers back in 1921 when it was dedicated. We have pictures of the dedication, Fort Blue Mounds dedicated. The landowners had donated to the Wisconsin Historical Society. But through the years, it had been forgotten about. Adjacent farmers had accidentally knocked down the pillars. Time and land use just erased evidence of the fort. We had a hill. Somewhere we had the fort, and somewhere state historical site of property held the fort. So we were puzzled. There was a historic marker, a little historic marker said site of Fort Blue Mounds, but it was just a historic marker on a hill, so we didn't exactly know where it was. I was concerned about the preservation because at that point already development was proceeding westward from Madison and within sight of the hill, subdivisions were occurring. So at that point, we decided, well, we better find out where the fort is and where our property is so it can be preserved in the event that this hill is someday developed. So we began a project in 1991 to locate the fort itself.
And what did you find?
Well, it took us a long time because normally a major excavation is very expensive. So instead of trying to get a lot of money to do the project, we enlisted a lot of volunteers. We have a lot of people here in Madison and elsewhere that are interested in archaeology, you know, in helping archaeologists. And so we had, through the years, we had over 100 volunteers. We had a small staff of archaeologists, and we excavated in the summer, only on weekends, so that people could help us sort of explore explore Wisconsin history in a hands-on way, you know. And so the excavations, interestingly, we almost immediately found a wall of the fort. And then we systematically followed that wall until the wall ended very abruptly. And excavations, year after year, we searched for more of the remains, and we found the historic markers that had originally been buried. And so we were starting to piece together this whole story, but we became confused because we were looking for this huge 150-foot fort. Finally, excavations, we finally concluded and found the four corners of the fort. And it described a much smaller fort, but it did give us a location. And also, we found it was entirely within this small plot of property owned by the State Historical Society.
Yeah. So what kind of artifacts did you find?
We found the artifacts told a very interesting story about the site. Obviously, the site had been started as the fort, but we also found a lot of artifacts and features that dated a bit later, up into about 1850.
So were people going up there and having picnics or what?
No. What we were able to deduce from the features and so on is that once the fort had been made and you had these nice blockhouses, and the blockhouses were probably about 10 to 15 foot in on a side, you had regular log cabins. And so the miners at Ebenezer's Brigham, remember this had been a lead mine. So we have a reference by Ebenezer Brigham in his account book in which he allocates some food to the fort establishment. This is after the Black Hawk War. So obviously now this was where the miners were also living. So this added something very special to us because now we had not just a Black Hawk War fort, but a glimpse of early settlement in Dane County, Wisconsin, leading up to 1850s. The kinds of artifacts we found included a lot of what you'd expect to find, lots and lots of musket balls and shot, you know, and so on. Most of the ammunition was shot, however, not musket balls, confirming that they had very few guns. You know, they were using their shotguns, but not the military-style guns and so on. And they were making their own ammunition. We found pieces of molds in which they were making. So they weren't being supplied by the military. They were making their own ammunition. But we also found, you know, parts of the fort itself, you know, nails and so on, but also a very interesting slice of material culture of Wisconsin during the frontier days. For example, and this is sort of something that I'm always very interested in, a lot of ceramics, a lot of dishware from the period, all of which is English, and most of which is beautifully decorated using processes called transfer printware and so on. These are all very characteristic of the period in England and eastern United States, but also on the frontier. The closest place to Blue Mounds in which to get anything would be Fort Winnebago, some distance away, or Mineral Point and so on. So they're pretty much out of the picture in terms of just going down to the store and buying some pottery, you know.
Right.
But the pottery that was showing up in the site, again, was all English made. It was imported from England and, again, had all these wonderful styles. And this showed us something, as archaeologists, I kind of knew before, but really this brought it home, is that the settlers coming out here valued pottery in dishware as symbols of civilization in what they considered to be a very uncivilized world. So they went to great lengths to make sure that they had up-to-date English pottery in their cabins and even these remote log cabins. And this is characteristic of the whole frontier. Pottery and ceramics went way beyond simple utilitarian purpose. It was, in fact, a huge symbol of civilization that they needed on the frontier.
It was something for which you would take comfort. Our guest has been Robert Birmingham, filling us in about life at Fort Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, a phenomenon of the Black Hawk War. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.